If you can wrap your head around what it is that you're doing, and if you can really find great enjoyment in what you're doing, then just go for it. Don't let anyone stop you. And just be the best that you can be. And that's all I ever want from anyone who works here. Just go off and do something better than what you did here.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. We've talked about how many hospitality businesses are family run, but not so much how members of the same family can branch off and have a huge impact on their own. Siblings growing up in the same environment, but taking their inspiration and experience on different paths to carve their own path. Matt McConnell is the executive chef and co-owner of Bar Larinia in Melbourne. Matt, how are you going?
Pretty good, thanks, Huck. How are you?
I'm good. You've got a couple of brothers that have made a bit of influence as well in the industry, and Andrew and Sean. How competitive is the sibling rivalry when it comes to food?
I think we pretty much put our professional side to one side now. I think we've all been doing our thing for quite some time, and we have our own goals and aspirations. And if anything, probably a little bit more support now than anything for us just to get on and do our own thing, which is always in the beginning probably the hardest thing, because we all sort of took off in the industry doing things somewhat linked, and then went on our own ways.
Well, you're all doing very different things and have really sort of stamped your authority as in your own right. You've got Bar Larinia at the moment. Tell us about what it's like at the moment. You know, the last 2 years have been a bit of a hurdle, but what's the picture looking like at the moment?
Yeah, it looks pretty good right now. I think the only thing that bothers me is up until Omicron, I pretty much had a pretty good crystal ball of how it was all playing out. And so I had a pretty good idea and prediction of when we were going to go into lockdown, when we were going to come out of lockdown, all those sorts of challenges that popped up along that way. And then when Omicron came along, it was a real kind of out of the blue, like, Jesus, what the hell is this? And wasn't really ready for it. And I think probably the biggest effect was staff catching COVID whilst at work, which was really quite distressing, especially in December. On paper, our December looked to be bigger and stronger than any December trade that we'd done in our 16-year history. So it looked amazing. But then all of a sudden, we had some staff catch it who were looking after a function upstairs in our private dining room. So at that stage, all of us had to, because we were all working together, we all had to get PCRs and wait. So we had to close for 2 days. And then similar thing happened again later in the month. We weren't able to trade, I think, about 6 or 7 days in the whole month because of just lack of staff, or, you know, key members having it and just not being able to field a strong enough team. So it was pretty devastating. And I think the only thing that got us through that is the customers were really accepting and understanding of it. And if anything, you know, it was quite obvious from mid-December, a group of 30 would only be 18 or 19. So we were really quite prepared for these juggles and downturns in those group numbers, but didn't really foresee having to close. And then obviously coming through into January, just the staff shortage issue, which is ongoing, has been something that hasn't really been addressed a great deal, especially in this election as well. And it's an issue not just for our industry, but for so many other industries, and it's global by from what I've spoken to people overseas. So it's ongoing, but it does feel pretty good. Customers are a lot more settled now. They don't have to check in. We don't have to check for their vaccination status, all that sort of thing. So that sort of tension and anxiety that comes with the customer, but also has a fairly solid impact on our staff, is thankfully relieved quite a bit. But I think there's definitely going to be, you know, a good amount of post-traumatic stress in the industry, which will carry on for some time. But we've got a great team, we've got a great crew, we've supported a lot of people through hard times, and they've supported us through a lot of really difficult times. So it's kind of brought us together. But yeah, no doubt a lot of sleepless nights and stress and tearing out hair or losing hair and going grayer and all that sort of stuff. But yeah, it does feel a lot more stable.
You mentioned that customers were a lot more understanding sort of during that period. Do you think the relationship between the operator and customers has changed through this experience?
I think, we've have a privileged position being in business for 16 years. So we have 16 years of ridiculously loyal clientele. So as soon as we had to go into lockdown, they were on the phone, they were emailing, what can we buy? You know, what are you doing this week? So that sort of support was quite phenomenal. And I think it just strengthened my relationship to my business as well and going, oh, my God, we've actually done something for a long time that's actually been part of a very strong community. And I don't think I'd really kind of acknowledged it. All these people who were having their wedding anniversaries, they had their first date at Ballerina, they were in lockdown. They wanted to celebrate their wedding anniversary because they've met at our place. And, people have gone on to have kids. And it's just, I think it did make it feel a little bit bigger than just a little bar in the city. And that connection and that reach was pretty special and important.
16 years for Ballerina is pretty incredible, and I want to explore what that 16 years has been like. But take us back to when you were young. What sort of role did food play in your family?
So I come from a very big family. So I'm one of six kids. Fairly typically white Anglo-Saxon sort of upbringing. But one thing that stood out was mum and dad, but mum especially was quite the gourmet, and also wanted to sort of explore outside what she'd only learnt in her time growing up, and a very limited range of styles of food. And she was quite adventurous and always trying different things, always entertained a lot. We always had people coming over. So, a dinner table of eight, which would be normal, would grow to, upwards of 20 or more. And so food and drink was important. But I think a lot of the things that we relied on was pretty much the staple of the time for white Anglo Australians. A lot of lamb, sausages on the weekend. The one thing that we did, which was fun, was a pizza night every Sunday night, from making the dough to making pizzas as a family was always good fun. It was never the most important thing of the day, but I think sitting down at the table was more important rather than what was on the table. And something that, I've really wanted to do with my young family as well, make sure that we sit down and we eat and talk and explore what's going on in the day and what's going to happen tomorrow, and then also do it over some lovely food as well.
Do you remember when you first sort of got interested in food and considered a career as a chef?
Yeah, look, I was kind of like a piggyback, I suppose, into the industry in that when I left high school, I'd kind of done very, very basic cooking at home. While I was in high school, I'd maybe cook once a month or something, but it was very simple and not very good. Andrew is a little bit older, a couple of years older than me, and he had entered the industry. And so when I was at university, I ended up getting part-time work, working as a kitchen hand, mostly in kitchens that he was working in. So I did that for two and a bit years of my arts degree, and then realised that the arts degree wasn't really what I wanted to do, and was just building up sort of that confidence and sort of looking around kitchens and just going, I kind of like this environment. It's a bit of pressure. There's definitely got a sense from the cooks at the end of their day that they've felt that they'd accomplished quite a bit. And I just wasn't feeling that in my academic life at all, and didn't really see the future in it. So an opportunity sort of was thrown my way to start an apprenticeship. So I thought, look, I've got nothing to lose. I can defer for a year, do a first-year apprenticeship, weigh it up at the end of that year. And as it turned out, I was literally 3 or 4 months into it, and it was not even a consideration to go back. I was just really enjoying that work environment. and worked for some really, really good people. A couple of bad ones at the start, but some really good ones also. So it was kind of good to have that mix of experience instead of not just all bad or all just too rosy. Sort of gave me a good picture of what the industry was consisted of. But I was also exposed to other cultures as well, which is really, really cool, which sort of had a big impact on where I went in my future cooking.
Well, what were some of the venues or people that sort of had a major impact on sort of the path that you've carved in those early years?
Sure. Look, I made a conscious decision. Back then it was pretty normal to, when you did an apprenticeship, you did pretty much your whole time at the one place. And I just saw that as a little bit too narrow because I wasn't really sure where I wanted to be in the industry. So I purposely took jobs that were quite different. So I did a year back then they were called a posh pub, so a gourmet pub, which is great. So it was working in a pub is pretty interesting, really interesting people. And the food was great. I worked with a fantastic chef there called Tony Garita, and learned a lot from him. Really passionate guy, really super passionate. And T. Ezard was the sous chef for a little while there as well. So I got to meet some pretty incredible people at on their journey as well. After that, I did a year in a cafe called Rumbarella's, which was a pretty groundbreaking little cafe in Brunswick Street at the time. Fresh made pasta every day. Just did things right, and I learned a lot from that experience. And the freshness of what they did was really interesting. And then after that, I did a year at a French bistro, which I'll just pass on that one because it just didn't fit me at all. It was probably the one link out of the 4 years that I did that just didn't quite gel. I wasn't very good to begin with, so I'll take that. But it just wasn't right for me. And then the last year of my apprenticeship, I did with Tansy at Tansy's in Spring Street, and that sort of she was pretty groundbreaking. And I just learned so much from her in a short time. She's extremely giving. Like I don't think I've worked with anyone that actually gives so much to her craft and to her customers and to her staff. It was quite pivotal, I think, in my professional sense. But then post that, I think it was the last year of my apprenticeship, I met my now wife. So we were partners for a while before getting married, and she's half Italian, half Greek. So that sort of took me on another journey of discovering food, which was going to her family villages in both the south of Italy and also on a little island in Greece, where I think we travelled for 10 months the first time we went, which was in 95. So I was probably only a year out of my apprenticeship. And those 9 months spent between Italy and Greece, living in a little village in Italy where no one spoke English, and they had they grew everything, made everything. It was I probably learned more in that 9 months than I did my whole apprenticeship. And the other side that I learned, not just the cooking part, was the hospitality side, which you just don't get that. I think we didn't get that back then in an apprenticeship. So just to see what it's like to sit down at a table, everyone comes together, brings all this produce from their farm. If there's a group of families meeting, someone will bring the wine, someone will bring the limoncello. In Greece, it was someone would bring the feta down from the farm, and there was another little plot of land where they'd pick all the vegetables for the salad, and would all make the salad together and sit down, talk, and drink and have fun, which kind of resembled a little bit what I did growing up with my family, but it was a whole nother cultural edge and twist and eye-opener, which kind of set me on a new course, I think, and reset me in the direction that I've sort of continued on.
What was it like stepping back into commercial kitchens after such a beautiful and unique experience in Italy and Greece?
It was really hard. It was really difficult. Probably the main thing is I just wanted to go back as well. It was such a powerful impact. And, you know, I had the opportunity to go and live and work in London like everyone. It was almost the rite of passage kind of thing. And I landed a job, and I was just like, why the hell am I putting myself in a basement, cold London in the middle of winter? £200 a week was the offer. So I was going to be losing about 200 quid a week to take the job where I can go and live off the land and experience something a little bit more relevant and something that I can also take back as experience to Australia eventually. So that was always my back of my head to keep traveling, to go back. But I sort of squandered a few jobs and was doing a bit of casual work and a bit of this until I got the opportunity to run a kitchen called at Hairy Canary, which I think I landed that in late 96. So I ran that for 3 years, 3 to 4 years. And that was a great job on many levels, because I was able to apply a lot of the things that I'd picked up on travels and use it quite constructively in a commercial kitchen. It was a time in the city of Melbourne where there weren't that many venues, but you could see the CBD really starting to change and have the opportunity to change. And so being part of that was great. I got to see the city go from, you know, lights out at 6 o'clock, no, and the streets would be empty, to, you know, the city council would be throwing comedy festivals and this and that, and there'd be people on the street all night wanting to go out, and bar culture was born sort of in that time as well in the CBD. And it was a really positive part of my cooking, actually, and having my first head chef position doing that was just really set me up, I think. And I worked hard. I think all that early training of working hard really paid off, and it didn't feel like hard work. It was quite satisfying. Started to make connections, early connections with not so much farmers, but more people at the markets. And I think that's when I started to question, why have I been cooking in a city and I don't even know where my herbs come from? I don't know. So I started exploring that a bit towards the end of my time at Hairy Canary.
What did you do in Melbourne leading? I know you spent some time up in Noosa as well before Ballarinia, but in the lead up to that gig, what was sort of the main moments for you?
I think Hairy Canary was pretty critical. Also, opening Dining Room 201 with Andrew was a pretty major stepping stone for both of us. And Sean's quite a bit younger than both of us, so he was kind of only just at that point sort of making decisions about where to go in the industry as well. So there was looking like all of a sudden the Von Trapp family chefs were coming strong and fast. It was... And obviously with that came a lot of pressure. It's like, why are you a cook? Mum must be a fantastic chef, blah, blah, blah. And it's kind of like, well, we didn't really overthink it that much until that point when everyone wanted to know why there are three chefs. So with that came a little bit of weird stuff, I think. And dining room wasn't the right fit for me as well. And then an opportunity came. I got a cold call from Jim Barato up in Noosa. And said, I hear you're looking for work. Why don't you come up for a weekend? We'll have a chat. We'll show you what we've got and we'll take it from there. And I just went, you know, it's a no-strings opportunity to go up to Noosa, have a couple of days. And I just thought, look, if it doesn't work out, at least I'll probably go and have a swim at the beach, you know. It'll be fun. And I got there and I was really kind of blown away with their operation, their outlook, but also their connection to their community and their farms and their fishermen. And I just thought, wow, this is something I could really jump on. And also just really, really fell in love with Jim and Greg as well. They were really, really good people, wanting to do really big things for a small town. So I just thought this could really work. So Joe and I made the move north, which I learned a lot in that time. I think... The restaurants, I ran the bistro and then ran the restaurant, and once again, they weren't really the most perfect fit for me, but I still managed to really learn a lot and bring a lot to those venues just by connecting with really good farmers and fishermen and all the suppliers that you dealt with up there, and some really good young cooks as well. Like, I was really surprised at how strong the cooking culture was up there as well. And plus as well, I'd gone from doing, you know, 80-hour weeks, and you'd finish at midnight and you'd get home at 6 o'clock in the morning and then you'd sleep all day. And it went from that to all of a sudden I was getting up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I'd either go fishing before work, or I'd go swimming before work. On my break, if I was doing a split shift, I'd go to the beach and swim for an hour and then go back and cook, and just kind of like sort of slowed my process down a lot, I think, by having that lifestyle and just going, oh, there's more to life than what I'd been doing. So it was a good change of pace, but still having a finger on the pulse. And, you know, I got to meet some of the most incredible chefs and hospitality people in Noosa, because Jim and Greg always, obviously, they set up the festival, so I was part of that at the very infancy as well, and got to meet some really amazing people, and that sort of had a great impact on me as well, I think. And I think at that point when I was time to leave Noosa, which is when I was sort of craving to do something of my own in Melbourne, but didn't really know what it was going to be, which is why we took off overseas for a year, spent most of it in Spain and Portugal, headed back to the family in both Italy and Greece again, but spent most of it in Spain and Portugal, which is when we went, this is what we have to do when we get back. We're not sure how we're going to do it or what it's going to look like, or but we just sort of knew that was the style of eating and drinking that we wanted to bring back to Melbourne. And, you know, that journey turned into, you know, looking at bars and how high, what was the best height for a bar stool, and all the little things and bits and pieces that make a great bar to eat at. And then it was quite glaring obvious to us about the style of hospitality that you get in those places. Some of the towns we'd go to, we spoke limited Spanish, but they'd welcome us into their bar like it was their home. And I think that really resonated with Joe and myself about how good hospitality can be. And we really wanted to bring just that slice, I think, back to Melbourne, and which ended up being Bar La Rigna.
Were there challenges bringing this concept into the market in Melbourne at the time?
I think we were incredibly lucky. We found the site while we were on the last part of our journey, which was in Greece. Jo was waiting to get her Greek passport, which was just the bureaucratic nightmare, but it just meant that we ended up spending about 2.5 to 3 months on Samos, a tiny little island, which is, it's a very Greek island, not a highly touristed island. So we lived off the land there and stayed in an uncle's house, and wrote a lot of recipes. Back then it was, I think it was plugging internet. There was an internet cafe, and we'd go down there just to send emails and stuff. And we found a real estate site and found the site at 37 Little Collins Street, and thought that looks absolutely perfect for what we want to do. Came back, called the agent. It was rented already, said sorry. And so Joe, having just been fresh off the boat back from the Mediterranean, said, I'm going to put my grandmother's curse on whoever's leased it, and you'll be hearing from me. She said, you'll be calling me. This is her exact words. And she's hung up, and I said, Joe, you can't do that. You can't say that. I said, nope, he'll be calling me. You watch. So sure enough, about 2 or 3 weeks later, we got a phone call from the agent saying, hey, the partnership has folded on that property. Do you want to come and have a look at it? And we basically went there that day and signed up straight away. So that was a bit of luck. But I think also Melbourne was ripe for the picking in 2006. There was really only Mavida doing what we wanted to do, and they were doing a great job. But we could see things really starting to happen. So Long Grain opened, I think, in end of 2005. So that's down, I know, in on Little Bourke Street. There's a couple of other little holes in the wall sort of popping up here and there up that end of Little Collins Street. So we saw it as, you know, a prime opportunity to move in. The rent was good. Had a friend build the bar for us and, you know, beg, borrowed, stealed basically to make it all happen, and took in a partner as well to make it happen. Had to sell our home to do it. So, you know, it was like an all in gamble, but it just kind of sent normal. It didn't seem like a risk take at the time. Looking back, it's probably pretty bonkers. But at the time, it just kind of seemed normal, and that's what we were supposed, what we were destined to do. Probably always we set it up wanting to be those places that we went to in Spain that were 40, 50 years old. You know, like a lot of that hospitality was more driving to us than, you know, the Michelin star places and the fancier bars. And so we always kind of hope that, you know, that's the hospitality we bring, and, you know, maybe we'll make it to 10 years or 12 years. But turning 15 in a lockdown was last year was kind of like, oh, geez, we've made 15. Didn't get to have a party, but just kind of figured, you know, that's a pretty bloody monumental milestone for, you know, a little bar, sort of Mar and Par run kind of style. You know, we're very hands on, still very passionate about what we do, and I think pandemic kind of brought us right back into those roles as well. We were probably a little bit more one step out of the business at the time, and pandemic has got us back in. Yeah, it's still doing what it's doing, which is great.
Tell us a little bit about your food, and has it changed much over the last 16 years?
Good question. I think it's changed a little. I'm not overly influenced by trends. I'm probably more influenced purely by my own travels and what I read. But yeah, usually traveling is the ground for where everything kind of comes from for us. And in addition to that, you know, just having, you know, buying fish from the same guy for 16 years, you know, you have a relationship with him. You know, you call him Malacca when he sends you the bad stuff, and normally I don't have to do that. So, you know, you become really good friends with people, and you develop lifelong relationships with people, and then you hop on a plane, you go somewhere, you go, geez, why didn't I think of this? How did I miss out on this? And then you just gradually evolve it into the menu. And I think menu structure has stayed pretty much the same. You know, we do tapas and raciones, a couple of cheeses, some desserts. So that structure hasn't changed at all. We've never gone Dego or this or that. It's always been in that sort of style. Just, you know, knowing, you know, Chloe's going to have ripe habaneros, you know, come April time, so I can make some really hot sauce. And then I know what's going to be coming up next. From someone else. Unfortunately, one of my farmers who I've used for many, many years is just retired after buying from him for over 20 years. And the sad thing with that is his family don't want to take on the family business. So all of that knowledge and that heritage from Albert, and he's an old Italian market gardener. Is gone. But one thing that's really positive is there is a younger breed and a younger generation of farmers out there who are doing incredible things and bringing beautiful produce to the city, and they're not far away. They're really local. And so that's probably my strongest drive and inspiration at the moment, mainly because I haven't been able to travel, is just having those relationships and working with them really closely with people. In the past, I've found produce on travels and taken photos of it and said, what's this and can you grow it? And sure enough, and, you know, a year later, I've got these amazing African horn melons coming in, which were these crazy things that I saw at a market in Lisbon, and stuff like that. So it's really nice having that connection and working with people.
I think the last time I saw you was a couple of years ago, and you'd gone back to Noosa and cooked with your brothers for the first time in a long time. What was that like?
That was pretty good fun, actually. Yeah, it's a bit of a blur now. That's a few years ago. And we don't do it very – I think we've done it once since then. But, yeah, it's I don't know, it's quite a surreal feeling to cook with both of them at the same time. I have cooked with Sean once on one occasion, and he came down and cooked once at Ballerina, but it is quite different. And, you know, the Von Trapp family singer joke is, you know, it's pretty strong, you know, when it comes to three cooks. And, you know, the real irony is everyone knows about the three brothers, but no one knows about the three sisters, you know, and the three sisters are all incredibly good home cooks who all love food. They're all good at it, but they've chosen a completely different path in life, which isn't hospitality. So, yeah, it's real. I still find it pretty surreal, actually.
16 years is incredible for any restaurant, any place on the planet. What do you love about what you do?
I think it's definitely the people. I love cooking, but the people are what makes it brilliant or makes it terrible. You know, bad customers can completely ruin a night. Great customers can actually make your year. So it's one of those fine lines. And then just working closely with young cooks and just trying to get in their head, you know, it's not all about being famous. It's about just do what you love. You know, really just if you can wrap your head around what it is that you're doing, and if you can really find great enjoyment in what you're doing, then just go for it. Don't let anyone stop you. And just be the best that you can be. And that's all I ever want from anyone who works here. Just go off and do something better than what you did here. It's really, really important. And it's also how the industry will evolve in a positive way, because still quite a lot of hate towards our industry. But it's an important part of culture, especially Melbourne culture. I think Melbourne culture is very, very driven by dining out, eating out, drinking out.
Well, Matt, it's an absolute honour to have you on Deep in the Weeds today, just to hear a bit of your story. Please keep in touch and we'll catch up again soon.
Thanks, Huck.
This is the Deep in the Weeds podcast. I'm Anthony Huckstep. Stay tuned as we take a deep dive into the lives of the incredible people who ply their trade in the food and hospitality sector.
Special thanks to executive producer Rob Locke for making this all happen.
Follow us on Instagram at Deep in the Weeds Podcast, or email us at podcast@deepintheweeds.com.au.
Stay safe and be well.